Chapter 27. Cape Fear. Imagine a world where good, honest, hard-working, inquisitive scientists live in fear of ruining their careers, perhaps even of losing their jobs and incomes, if they investigate certain subjects that have been judged by a dominant elite to be taboo. Is such a climate of fear-based conformity likely to result in good science that breaks new ground? Or is it likely to keep science stuck in a rut, endlessly refining and reconfirming established models, while rejecting any evidence that suggests those models might be wrong or in need of fundamental revision? These are not rhetorical questions, because it turns out that this imaginary world is the very world we live in today. Science in the 21st century does not encourage scientists to take risks in their pursuit of the facts, particularly when those facts call into question long-established notions about the human past. The controversy surrounding the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis is an example. Since it was first proposed formally in 2007, the scientists behind it have endured an unrelenting barrage of deeply unpleasant and self-serving attacks from a small but influential group of other scientists whose work and opinions are challenged by the notion of a comet-induced global cataclysm 12,800 years ago. In my 2015 book, Magicians of the Gods, I give a detailed account of the major studies supporting the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, coupled with an equally detailed evaluation of the attacks made on the hypothesis up to that point. I will not repeat the same information here, since it is on record and can easily be consulted. My conclusion at the time was that the attacks were generally unjustified, misleading, and propagandistic, and that the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis constitutes the best possible explanation for the earth-shaking events of 12,800 years ago. Now, as I write these words in 2018, my desk is covered with papers published during the past 3 years, presenting a great mass of new evidence that very strongly reinforces, extends, and develops the original Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. The biomass burning and platinum studies mentioned in Chapter 26 are the jewels in the crown, which is why I focused on them in the limited space available here. I'm more confident than ever that the Comet Research Group scientists are on the right track, and I hold them in the highest regard for speaking truth to power and being willing to stick their necks out. I was therefore excited when George Howard, not a scientist, but an environmental restoration specialist and a supporter of CRG, who edits the online magazine Cosmic Tusk, contacted me to suggest a meet-up with some of the leading members of the group during my fall 2017 research trip across the United States. On the same trip, I met Al Goodyear and Alan West, and now here was an opportunity to exchange views with some of their other colleagues. The meet-up was scheduled for Wilmington, North Carolina, on November 13th and 14th, 2017. Chris Moore and Malcolm LeCompte, co-authors of both the platinum and the biomass burning papers, would join us from the University of South Carolina, together with their colleague Mark Demitroff of Stockton University in New Jersey, co-author of several earlier papers providing solid support for the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. I invited my friend and colleague Randall Carlson to drive in from Atlanta to be part of the discussions. His work connecting impacts on the North American ice cap 12,800 years ago to the immense flood damage in the channeled scablands of eastern Washington state is discussed extensively in Magicians of the Gods. And I was pleased to learn that George Howard had also asked Antonio Zamora to be there. An independent researcher, a chemist, and a computer scientist, Zamora is not a member of CRG and has nothing whatsoever to do with the group, but I had recently read an intriguing paper he had published earlier in 2017 in the peer-reviewed journal Geomorphology, tracing the origins of the Carolina Bays to the Younger Dryas impacts. Around 500,000 peculiar elliptical ponds, depressions, and lakes with raised rims pock much of the United States Atlantic seaboard, from Delaware to Florida. Since it was in the Carolinas that scientists first noticed them in the late 19th century, they became known as Carolina Bays, and from quite early on, there were theories that they had been created by an immense swarm of meteorites striking the Earth. Several CRG members have explored the possibility that the Younger Dryas impacts might be connected to the mystery, but the majority of the group have since distanced themselves from such notions. Dating studies indicate that the bays were not all created simultaneously, as the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis would require, but are of widely varying ages, separated by tens of thousands of years. Antonio Zamora's 2017 paper in Geomorphology put the cat among the pigeons by raising an interesting scenario whereby the bays could, after all, have resulted from Younger Dryas impacts. I had naively assumed that Malcolm Lecomte and Mark Dimitrov, who were then both CRG members but have since resigned, would welcome this new research. I couldn't have been more wrong. Glacier Ice Impact Hypothesis. Let's start by taking a proper look at the controversial proposals behind the glacier ice impact hypothesis that Antonio Zamora puts on the table in his geomorphology paper. He begins by recognizing earlier evidence that discounts the Carolina Bays as impact features, but then draws our attention to an intriguing mystery, the so-called Nebraska rainwater basins. Other than being oriented from northeast to southwest, instead of from northwest to southeast, an important piece of evidence in itself, these curious elliptical geological formations more than 2,000 kilometers west of the Carolinas greatly resemble the bays. The Nebraska rainwater basins, Zamora argues, are not as well known as the Carolina Bays, but their elliptical shape is so similar that it is necessary to consider that they formed contemporaneously with the Carolina Bays by the same mechanisms. The objective of the glacier ice impact hypothesis is to examine the characteristics of the Carolina Bays and Nebraska rainwater basins to determine whether these geomorphological features could have been created by secondary impacts from terrestrial material, such as glacier ice, ejected by an extraterrestrial impact. Zamora is the first to acknowledge that his glacier ice impact hypothesis depends heavily on prior work done by two other investigators, Michael E. Davias and Thomas H. S. Harris, the former a specialist in geospatial big data, data mining, computer graphics, and algorithms, and the latter a dynamics and flight science expert at Lockheed Martin Corporation. Michael Davias accompanied Zamora to Wilmington and shared with us there the evidence that he and Harris had first presented in May 2015 at the 49th annual meeting of the Geological Society of America. Published as a conference paper, their proposal is that a cosmic impact during the Ice Age in Michigan's Saginaw Bay, which was then solid land covered by deep glacial ice, would have produced ejecta and secondary impacts in a butterfly wing pattern precisely over the Nebraska rainwater basins, where they would have been oriented northeast to southwest, and the Carolina Bays, where they would be oriented northwest to southeast. While he has no quarrel with Alan West, Richard Firestone, and other CRG scientists who suspect that there may have been a total of 8 impacts on the North American ice cap, Zamora focuses his investigation on the Michigan event, proposed by Davias and Harris to have been specifically responsible for the simultaneous creation both of the Carolina Bays and of the Nebraska rainwater basins. Saginaw Bay, the suggested impact site, is commonly attributed to erosion by the Saginaw glacial lobe, penetrating through the Mississippian and Pennsylvanian cuestas, Davias and Harris concede, but propose instead that it is the footprint of an oblique impact arriving at an azimuth of 222 degrees. Given 1 kilometer of ice over this footprint, 45,000 cubic kilometers of water would have been instantly ionized or vaporized. Meanwhile, the shock effects of the impact, although somewhat mitigated by the ice cover, would have bulldozed into the ancient promontory of bedrock then beneath the ice at the center of the Michigan Basin, plowed out the gap in the mitten that we now call Saginaw Bay, and sent up a massive ejecta consisting of pulverized Michigan sandstone from the bedrock and water from the vaporized ice. Blasted into suborbital space, this ejecta would then have re-entered the atmosphere and fallen back to Earth, with the end result being a sort of slurry that spattered down across much of the continental United States south of the ice sheet, but that only left impressions such as the Carolina Bays and the Nebraska rainwater basins on suitably soft and unconsolidated ground. When Davias and Harris gave their paper at the Geological Society of America in 2015, they tentatively suggested an age of 786,000 years for the formation of Saginaw Bay. While drawing on their excellent ballistics and triangulation work, Zamora's presentation of his own glacial ice impact hypothesis in his 2017 paper in Geomorphology rejects so great an age and offers a compelling case that Saginaw Bay was scooped out just 12,800 years ago by one of the fragments of the Younger Dryas comet. On technical grounds, to do with the thermodynamics of water in the liquid state, he also rejects Davias and Harris's notion that the ejecta would have consisted of a foam of sand and water. According to Zamora's calculations, massive quantities of solid glacial ice would instead have been blasted aloft. Experiments of high-speed impacts on ice sheets using NASA's Ames vertical gun demonstrate that ice shatters when a projectile hits it. Pieces of ice are ejected, radiating from the impact site in ballistic trajectories. The Laurentide ice sheet, writes Zamora, covered the convergence point determined by Davias and Harris in Saginaw Bay with a thickness of approximately 1,000 to 2,000 meters of ice during the Pleistocene. Ballistic equations, scaling laws relating crater size to impact energy, geometrical analysis, and statistical analysis provide a mathematical foundation for explaining the shape of the bays and their origin from secondary impacts of glacier ice ejected from the Laurentide ice sheet that covered Michigan. It's important to be clear on this, just as Zamora does not support Davias and Harris's idea that the ejecta consisted of pulverized sandstone and water. So, too, he adamantly does not suggest that hundreds of thousands of fragments of the original Younger Dryas comet bombarded North America's Atlantic seaboard, creating the phenomenon of the Carolina Bays. Neither is he suggesting that the Nebraska rainwater basins were the result of direct hits by comet fragments. Instead, he accepts the CRG's long-established position that the epicenter of the impacts was the North American ice cap. In his view, all the damage in the Carolinas and Nebraska was done by the stupendous mass of icy ejecta, varying in size from basketballs to ice boulders, tens or even hundreds of meters across, that fell back to Earth following the Saginaw Bay impact. An apocalyptic vision. I refer the listener to Zamora's paper itself for the detailed evidence behind his findings. In summary, however, having first reviewed and rejected all other explanations for the formation of the bays and basins, and having given special consideration to the longer-term evolution of impact craters on viscous surfaces, Zamora concludes as follows. The radial orientation of the Carolina Bays and Nebraska rainwater basins towards a convergent point in Michigan, and the elliptical shapes of the bays with specific width-to-length ratios, can be better explained by impact mechanisms than by terrestrial wind and water processes. The glacier ice impact hypothesis has been supplemented with an experimental model demonstrating that oblique impacts on viscous surfaces can reproducibly create inclined conical cavities that are remodeled into shallow elliptical depressions by viscous relaxation. This makes it possible to model the Carolina Bays and Nebraska rainwater basins as conic sections whose width-to-length ratio can be explained by the angle of impact. Zamora addresses the issue of the great diversity of dates for the Carolina Bays obtained by optically stimulated luminescence, OSL, noting that this has hitherto been the most significant barrier to acceptance of any form of impact hypothesis with reference to the bays. As he rightly points out, however, the fundamental assumption behind the use of OSL has been that the subsurface of the Carolina Bays was exposed to light at the time of bay formation. His experimental model refutes this, by demonstrating that impacts on viscous surfaces are plastic deformations that do not expose the subsurface to light. Therefore, Zamora argues, OSL can only determine the date of the terrain, but not the date of the formation of the bays. If all the Carolina bays and Nebraska rainwater basins formed contemporaneously, it will be necessary to find a different way of dating them. The glacier ice impact hypothesis explains all the features of the Carolina bays and Nebraska rainwater basins, including their elliptical shape, radial orientation, raised rims, undisturbed stratigraphy, absence of shock metamorphism, overlapping bays, and the occurrence of bays only in unconsolidated ground. Finally, and chillingly, Zamora's paper in Geomorphology notes, "The great surface density of the bays indicates that they were created by a catastrophic saturation bombing with impacts of 13 kilotons to 3 megatons that would have caused a mass extinction in an area with a radius of 1,500 kilometers from the extraterrestrial impact in Michigan." This paper has considered mainly the ice boulders ejected by an extraterrestrial impact on the Laurentide ice sheet during the Pleistocene, but the impact would also have ejected water and produced steam. Taking into consideration the thermodynamic properties of water, any liquid water ejected above the atmosphere would have been transformed into a fog of ice crystals that would have blocked the light of the sun. Thus, the time of formation of the Carolina Bays and Nebraska rainwater basins must coincide with an extinction event in the eastern half of the United States and the onset of a period of global cooling. This combination of conditions is best met by the disappearance of the North American megafauna, the end of the Clovis culture, and the onset of the Younger Dryas cooling event at 12,800 calendar years before the present. The report of a platinum anomaly, typical of extraterrestrial impacts at the Younger Dryas boundary, supports this scenario. In his book, Killer Comet, Zamora elaborates on the extent and true horror of the Younger Dryas cataclysm. He considers how the effects of the primary impact over Michigan would have been massively compounded across North America by the secondary impacts of glacier ice boulders. It's instructive to spend a few moments with the disturbing picture he paints, which I shall quote at length here. "All living things within 100 kilometers of the Michigan impact died instantly. They were either burned by the heat blast or killed by the shock wave. On the East Coast, 1,000 kilometers from the impact zone, the blinding flash on the horizon was followed by a sky that darkened ominously as it filled with the giant ice boulders ejected by the impact. 3 minutes after the flash, the dark sky advanced relentlessly, and the ground shook as the first seismic waves from the extraterrestrial impact site arrived, traveling at 5 kilometers a second. By this time, all animals and humans were aware that something terrible was happening. The sky continued to darken, and then filled with bright streaks as the ice boulders, in suborbital flights, re-entered the atmosphere at speeds of 3 to 4 kilometers a second. As the giant ice boulders started falling, the thumping of the impact sent shockwaves through the ground that traveled at 5 to 8 kilometers a second. The shaking ground started to liquefy, trapping everyone. The ground had turned to quicksand, making it impossible to walk or run. At the peak of intensity, a hail of glacier ice chunks, many as big as a baseball stadium, left steam trails in the sky as they re-entered the atmosphere at supersonic speeds and crashed into the liquefied ground, accompanied by the thunder of sonic booms. The impacts created oblique, muddy, conical craters with diameters of 1 to 2 kilometers that swallowed whole villages and buried all the vegetation. The vibration of the ground quickly reduced the depth of the conical craters and turned them into the shallow depressions that we know today as the Carolina Bays. The comet itself had not killed the megafauna. The saturation bombardment by the ice boulders that were ejected when the comet struck the Laurentide ice sheet caused the extinction event. The landscape of the eastern seaboard had been transformed into a barren wasteland, full of huge, shallow mud holes. The Carolina Bays have remained as evidence of the glacier ice impacts on the soft, sandy soil of the East Coast. No such evidence remains of the ice chunks that must have fallen on harder ground. But the ice impacts in the central and midwestern states were equally merciless. When the colossal chunks of glacier ice hit the hard terrain, they shattered and sent out ice fragments at high speed. Any creature or vegetation in the path of the fast-moving ice shards was destroyed. When the ice finally came to rest, the ejecta blanket had covered one half of the contiguous United States with a thick layer of crushed ice that increased the albedo of the Earth and reflected a significant portion of the dimmer light from the sun back into space. The combined effect of the increased ice cover and the orbiting ice crystals would make the land cold and inhospitable for many years. The buried vegetation would freeze or remain dormant under the ice. Grazing animals that had survived the glacier ice bombardment had no access to their normal food sources and would soon starve. Predators that were still alive would also soon die without their herbivorous prey. Eventually, North America would be repopulated by new land animals and new humans, but the megafauna and the ingenious Clovis people that had crafted such fine stone projectiles were gone forever. Zamora's is an apocalyptic vision, to be sure, and we must remind ourselves that it deals with the widespread consequences of just one of the major impacts on the North American ice cap. Attack and destroy. As we've heard, Alan West and Richard Firestone propose that there may have been as many as 8 significant impacts on the North American ice cap during the 21 years of the peak Younger Dryas bombardments. Together with other scientists from the Comet Research Group, they have focused with great success on gathering the evidence for these bombardments in the form of impact proxies scattered across 50 million square kilometers of the Earth's surface. What none of the group has yet done, however, is investigate the full implications for North America itself of the hypothesized impacts on the ice cap. Why Antonio Zamora matters and why his work deserves serious evaluation is that he is the first to undertake such an exercise, albeit focused on only one out of the possible 8 impacts. In addition, he offers testable hypotheses and opens up new vistas for inquiry and discussion. I was therefore expecting to spend 2 constructive and thought-provoking days at Wilmington, sharing ideas with big thinkers and giving proper consideration for the first time to the implications of the icy fallout across North America that Zamora rightly calculates would have been the outcome of impacts on the ice cap. The opposite happened. It was clear from the outset that the only reason Malcolm LeCompte and Mark Demitroff were with us at Wilmington at all was to attack and destroy the glacier ice impact hypothesis at birth. There was no interest whatsoever in a discussion of the wider implications of Zamora's thinking. Their entire focus was to demonstrate that he was completely wrong to link the Carolina Bays to any kind of cosmic impacts, and to the Younger Dryas impacts in particular. At one level, this was all good. For science to progress, it's important that all ideas be tested in the fire of peer review. And while Zamora's hypothesis had already been through that fire once in order to have appeared in Geomorphology at all, here were other scientists who disagreed. Excellent. Bring it on, guys. I was at Wilmington to learn, and such constructive disagreements would surely only help me gain a better understanding of what no scientist today can yet claim to understand fully, namely the cause and true extent of the cataclysmic events that shook the Earth at the onset of the Younger Dryas 12,800 years ago. Because I'd gone into the meeting with the mindset that we were all colleagues here, trying to figure out a solution to one of the greatest mysteries of the past, I didn't initially expect the level of antagonism, hostility, scorn, and downright unpleasantness with which Zamora's impact hypothesis was received by LeCompte and Demitroff, who are themselves proponents of an impact hypothesis at the receiving end of a great deal of antagonism, hostility, scorn, and unpleasantness. But that was naivete on my part. Over the following months, I was to get a much clearer understanding of what was really going on. Extremely regrettable. After the Wilmington meeting, Santa and I flew to Little Rock, Arkansas, where I had a presentation to give at a conference before we returned to the United Kingdom. During my talk, which was filmed, I showed a photograph of myself with Chris Moore on a field trip to a Carolina Bay, John's Bay, where platinum had been found. I outlined the platinum research and other Younger Dryas impact hypothesis research in my presentation, and then moved on to a discussion of Antonio Zamora's glacier ice hypothesis. I did not connect his work to the work of the Comet Research Group, and I did not suggest he was a member of the Comet Research Group or had anything to do with it. The video was released on YouTube on January 26, 2018. A little over a month later, I found myself embroiled in heated email correspondence with Malcolm Lecomte and Mark Dimitroff. The first salvo was fired on March 9, 2018, with an email from Lecomte to Zamora, CC'd to me, titled Paper by Antonio Zamora, Geomorphology, 282, 2017, pages 209 to 216. That email accused me of providing extraordinary coverage of Zamora's speculative theory in my Little Rock presentation and of giving it exposure in juxtaposition with my discussion of the Younger Dryas boundary impact hypothesis. Describing my alleged association of Zamora's work with the work of the Comet Research Group as extremely regrettable, Lecomte added a postscript specifically addressed to me. Graham, I find Antonio's work to be unsupportable, not because impact proxies aren't found in the Bay Rims, as you apparently have been told and are now saying, but for the variety of reasons listed in the attached letter, first and foremost of which, because there was no ice in Saginaw Bay or anywhere within 200 kilometers of where Antonio believes his impact occurred. My bad about the impact proxies. I had indeed incorrectly stated in that hastily put together segment of my presentation that none were found in the Carolina Bay Rims, and that this was part of the long-established dismissal of any impact connection to the bays. I got that wrong. Platinum is an impact proxy, as I knew very well, and Chris Moore had found it in the Carolina Bays. Multiple other proxies, including magnetic grains and microspherules, carbon spherules, and glass-like carbon, have also been found, as a 2010 study reports, throughout the rims of 16 Carolina Bays. What I don't see, however, is how this helps Lecomte's claim that impacts did not make the bays. On the contrary, it seems to me that the presence of the proxies there only strengthens the case that the bays are impact-related. I shall certainly speak of this in future presentations. Much more significant is the second statement in the postscript, to the effect that 12,800 years ago, there was no ice in Saginaw Bay, or anywhere within 200 kilometers of the proposed impact site. Lecomte elaborates on this point in the longer letter attached to his email, formally addressed to the editor of Geomorphology, where he refers to a large body of literature providing evidence that Zamora's proposed point of impact had been deglaciated for more than 1,000 years before the onset of the Younger Dryas, and that not only Saginaw Bay, but all of Lake Huron had been ice-free when the Younger Dryas began. This seemed to be a fatal criticism of the glacier ice impact theory, but Zamora gave an immediate response to Lecomte.
In your note to the editor of Geomorphology, you say Dyke 2004 and Larsen and Schatzel 2001 provide graphical depictions of the retreat of the Laurentide ice sheet with sufficiently high spatial and temporal resolution to make clear that not only Saginaw Bay, but all of Lake Huron was ice-free at the time of the Younger Dryas onset. Let us say that no evidence can be found for glaciers at the point where the axial projections of the bays converge. Geologists usually determine the extent of glacier coverage by examining glacial striations on the terrain and by identifying deposits of erratic boulders. Would you expect the site of an extraterrestrial impact to retain these markers? Wouldn't the impact of a 3-kilometer asteroid obliterate striations and erratic boulders? The subsequent melting of the glaciers would then flood the impact point and wash away the last traces of the crater. The Carolina Bays do exist, and because they are conic sections, it is very likely that they originated as conical impact cavities. The Nebraska rainwater basins are now intimately related to the Carolina Bays through their geometry. Any modern publication about the Carolina Bays that ignores the Nebraska basins is incomplete and inadequate. In my paper, I mentioned that an extraterrestrial impact on hard ground would have sent rocky ejecta only one-third as far as an impact on ice. Moreover, an impact on land rather than on ice would have left a typical extraterrestrial crater. My bet is that there was an ice sheet wherever the meteorite hit, otherwise someone would already have found the crater. Frankly, I thought that Zamora had returned Malcolm's hardball quite well, and soon afterward he followed through by sending me a paper I hadn't come across before, published in Quaternary Science Reviews in 1986, titled Correlation of Glacial Deposits of the Huron, Lake Michigan, and Green Bay Lobes in Michigan and Wisconsin. The paper, by Donald Eshman and David Mickelson, concludes that following an earlier retreat, there was a re-advance of the ice sheet during the so-called Port Huron State around 13,000 years ago, and that at this time, both Saginaw Bay and Lake Huron were indeed covered with ice. Once again, therefore, as so often in science, statements touted as facts turn out to be opinions contradicted by other opinions that are also touted as facts. The truth of the matter is that there remains great uncertainty and confusion around exactly what happened in North America and across the whole world at the onset of the Younger Dryas. While that uncertainty persists, alleged certainties of almost any kind are inappropriate, and it is wise to keep an open mind to all possibilities. Beyond the issue of the absence or presence of an ice sheet at the proposed point of impact, Lecomte's dismissal of the glacier ice impact theory is, of course, supported by other evidence and reasoning, but my purpose here is not to get into these minutiae. I concede the possibility that Lecomte may be right, while remaining open to the possibility that he may be wrong. Either way, the real importance of Zamora's contribution has been to raise new questions around the matter of the Younger Dryas impacts. Only time and further research will tell whether this theory really solves the mystery of the Carolina Bays and the Nebraska rainwater basins, but he has undoubtedly done scholarship a service by exploring the ballistics and dynamics of explosive cosmic impacts on the North American ice cap, and by looking into the potentially disastrous consequences in terms of the subsequent storm of icy ejecta. You were repeatedly warned. The storm of ejecta from the Wilmington meeting was far from over. My exchange of emails with Malcolm Lecomte continued. Mark Demitroff joined the conversation as well, and both of them were clearly very annoyed with me. Chris Moore was CC'd but did not comment. What became clear from all this was that Lecomte's objection to the video was not that I had misrepresented the Comet Research Group in any way, or that I had misrepresented Chris Moore's recent research, but simply that right after what I had to say about the Comet Research Group, ending up with the visit I'd just made with Chris Moore to Johns Bay, I had gone on to talk about Zamora's glacier ice impact theory. On March 21, 2018, therefore, because I sensed there was something going on here that was worthy of reporting, and wanting no one involved to be in any doubt that I intended to report it, I began a new thread of emails under the subject line, "For the Record." I speak about the work of many scientists in the video. The fact that what I have to say about the work of one scientist follows what I have to say about the work of another scientist does not mean I am connecting the two unless I specifically do so, which I don't do here. I'm therefore really perplexed as to why this video has caused offense. I have no hesitation in sharing the bulk of Lecomte's reply because of the light it sheds on a growing problem within science in general, the problem of enforced conformity. Malcolm Lecomte to Graham Hancock, March 23, 2018. You were repeatedly warned that any association of Carolina Bay Genesis linked to a discussion of the Younger Dryas boundary impact event would likely be harmful to the progress of the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis research and to the reputations of its investigators. You may not be aware of the time and energy spent to largely neutralize the distracting effects and hostility created by the early Carolina Bay-related assertions made in the non-peer-reviewed book Cycle of Cosmic Catastrophes. This is a book co-authored by Richard Firestone and Alan West, the original formulators of the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, and published in 2006, a year before the first formal paper appeared in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. LeCompte's email continues. The association of Bay impact genesis with the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis created an early perception in some scientific communities that the Younger Dryas boundary impact research was both unprofessional and bordering on pseudoscientific. Those original, naive Bay genesis claims still haunt the research and contribute to hobbling its acceptance as a legitimate research activity for a new generation of scientists. We have few, relatively younger and seasoned tigers like Chris Moore, willing to disregard the real and perceived risks to their careers and reputations, and even fewer younger, newly trained scientists following in his footsteps to adopt what is still considered a somewhat controversial line of research. His participation in this research is noticed and monitored by his many colleagues. Nevertheless, only a week after our meeting, where Mark Dimitroff, with Chris's endorsement, had presented an evidence-based alternative to Zamora's proposed Bay impact genesis, you gave a video presentation that juxtaposed Younger Dryas impact hypothesis research with Zamora's very controversial claim of Bay impact genesis. Less than a month later, Chris Moore, probably the most important current and hopefully future investigator of the Younger Dryas boundary event, received a call from a colleague who had seen your YouTube video and posted it on his anti-pseudoscience website that is apparently visited by some of Chris's peers. Your presentation, juxtaposing Younger Dryas impact hypothesis research with Zamora's claims, certainly endowed them with some unwarranted credibility, but also contaminated the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis by the association. Chris achieved some unwanted negative celebrity among his colleagues. He was challenged about the wisdom of hosting you and suffered the indignity of wondering about the effect the video might have on his career and reputation. It is obvious to me that distribution of your video presentation has put Chris's reputation, career, and participation in the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis research in potential jeopardy. The resulting harm has yet to be completely comprehended. Fortunately, Chris made the brave decision to continue the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis research, despite that video's presence on YouTube, for the foreseeable future. Wow. All this stress, drama, and defensiveness over a video of a presentation I gave at a conference. I have to confess, I was taken aback by the vehemence of LeCompte's reply and the suggestion that I might have harmed the career of that very likable and diligent scientist, Chris Moore. But at a deeper level, what this whole exchange revealed to me was something disturbing about the way science works. I hadn't quite grasped the role of fear before, but I could see it in action everywhere here. Fear of being noticed and monitored by colleagues, fear of unwanted negative celebrity, fear of indignity, fear of loss of reputation, fear of loss of career, and not for committing some terrible crime, but simply for exploring unorthodox possibilities and undertaking somewhat controversial research into what everyone agrees were extraordinary events 12,800 years ago. Worse still, this pervasive state of fear has somehow ingrained itself so deeply into the fabric of science that those who have embraced unorthodox possibilities themselves are often among the least willing to consider unorthodox possibilities embraced by others, lest by doing so they contaminate their own preferred unorthodoxy. How will it ever be possible to discover the truth about the past when so much fear gets in the way?